The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 39.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. A couple of things first, before we get into the interview. Head over to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts, and there you can join my Eating Liberty Facebook group and check out all of us who are in there chatting away. You can also follow me on Twitter and Minds and Gab and bitbacker.io. You can also subscribe to my YouTube cooking channel and also support me with Patreon, Bitcoin, or PayPal. There's a lot going on that page. You can also support the show with a positive review and a 5-star rating on your favorite podcatcher. A big 5-star thank you to Rayaboy for the nice review and 5-star rating. Rayaboy is also host of his own podcast, Eye on 2020, offering a libertarian observation of the goings-ons in D.C. and in politics in general. Episode 117 dives into the deceptions and interest in starting war with Iran, which really only about 9 people care to do. Nobody else wants a war. Ray publishes a new episode each day and tackles some pretty big issues. Find his podcast at his webpage, eyeontheempire.com. For you coffee or tea or whiskey drinkers, I have a new coffee mug store. I add new mug designs frequently and can also talk to you about a custom mug. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/gearbubble. That's culinarylibertarian.com/GEARBUBBLE to see the selections and make your purchase. As listeners of this show, you've heard me mention the courses on economics and politics and history at Liberty Classroom. Now, there's coupons for each level of subscription, so you can save some bread, baking pun intended, as you bite back against the education from the state. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/biteback to see the coupon codes and then click through to subscribe and save some bread. Bite back against the failed education from the state and the coupons at culinarylibertarian.com/biteback. My guest today is Azur, and we're talking the cooking of India. Azur is in the food service business and has an incredible palate for flavors. Azur is from India, but during the past 20-plus years has spent time cooking in Saudi Arabia, Ontario, Canada, and various locations in the U.S., cooking both classical and nouveau French cuisine, Asian, and of course, Indian. We get into a bit of cooking philosophy, which means how did everyday Indians cook compared to what's printed on the page. We discuss how cooks, both home and professional, can get closer to the authentic ideas of a regional food by knowing the cooking processes over adhering to just those words on the page. We did struggle with some tech issues on his side, and I've cleaned that up the best I could. You can definitely hear him, but there are a few pops and scratches, but it's well worth your time. Welcome, Azur, to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Dan.
So before we get into any of this, I suppose if anybody really cares, we have a bit of a history. I think we figured out it's been about 15 years, maybe a little longer, that we worked together at the Governor's Club private dining club in Tallahassee, Florida. So it wasn't that I just saw your resume someplace online and said, hey, let me ask this guy about Indian cooking. I'm asking you about Indian cooking because I happen to know you're really good at Indian cooking. So that's why you're here. So now that we've gotten that probably unnecessary disclosure out of the way, give us just a little bit of your background in cooking, please.
So I got involved with cooking at an extremely early age when I used to help my mom just get dinner ready or do a small get-together for family. And my mom and my, I would say my parental side, that my mom's brothers and their whole family were very much into cooking and cooking different types of food. So a lot of it started at a very early age, you know, at the dinner table where we talked and ate. And we used to have, my mom has 9 brothers and no sisters. So she was, I would say, the center for all her 9 brothers and their families. And we would have quite a few large gatherings where we would be cooking in bulk, in quantity, cooking at home. And I don't remember too much whether we ate outside in restaurants. And the baton of having those family events was always passed within the family from one group to the other and to a bunch of potlucks and so on and so forth. So that was my earlier involvement with food and different types of cooking techniques and skills. And as I grew older, there was a time when I was really interested in the chef world, which was a very new concept in India during the time I was finishing my graduation. And in India, there were 3 main streams of being a graduate: science, mathematics, or biology. And I know you'll find this odd, but I got a bachelor's in science, and but I was really interested in food. And that's when Institute of Management came across to me as a different world where I would be able to look at some of my skills. And having done my culinary school, came the urge to do well, came the urge to travel across the world, because it opened up a Pandora's box for me, that there was more than Indian food, and there was French and Italian and you go on, American, and the list just goes on. Now, when I worked in India, obviously, you know, it's always like the food which is closest to you, you just take it for granted. And I always focused on French food and tried to learn it from some of the best French chefs and worked with a couple of French chefs. But as now that I've been in the US for the last 20 years, I have started realizing now that everything which is available so easily, it's American food, French, you have the availability. Now I'm steering back to remembering all the flavors of India, and food has always been a sort of an emotional attachment for me. It reminds me of time, smells, places, and people. And being an immigrant or migrated to the United States, I relate those emotional attachments with food and people, memories of my childhood as well as early years of my adolescence or growing up years, where I went to college and started looking into a career in the hospitality and food business. And here I am now, after X amount of years.
And here you are now. India is a big place. 7 territories, 29 states. That's a lot. It's kind of like saying there's a kind of an American food. Can we say there is such a thing as Indian cooking? Between that vast space, there's coastal and inland and northern and southern. So what, this is maybe not a fair question, but is there something that ties together all of these territories and regions and states?
I don't think there is a single cooking technique or food item which would bind and tie all those 29 states and territories. But what I can think about, the only some of the common ties are culture, religion, language, demographics, and ethnic backgrounds.
I want to ask you about
go ahead.
What is the, in a country that vast, what is the culture that's tying them together?
So culture is an extremely broad, complex mix when it comes to India. So we look at culture with which is associated with religion. And then along with religion comes the demographic location of those religious groups or ethnicity or ethnical backgrounds. So that's how I would look at culture when it comes to India.
Okay, and then is there just one language?
No, there is not one. I think the unifying language in India would be, thanks to the colonization, it would be English. So that would be, I mean, you could get away with talking English practically everywhere in India. But every part of India has a different language. It has a different dialect. So even if you choose, say, if you choose a state, a southern state like Karnataka or Tamil Nadu, you would travel for maybe in every 300, 400 miles, you may get a different version of a language with a different dialect. And the same goes with the north part of India. I mean, Indian food, as complex as Indian food is, the culture is not less complex, and neither is the demography of the country as such. Where you get right from snow-capped mountains to the coastals to the heat to the desert, you name it. I mean, there is not a single climate I can think of which is not included in India. I really can't think of anything which I have not seen, right from rains, monsoons, to all of it.
Well, I think that probably the reason we, being Westerners, Americans, have such little exposure is, well, it's far away, and there are some things that are much easier to transport. So one of the I think one of the first things people associate with Indian food, probably two things, and they're combined. One is it's just really hot, spicy hot, which probably is not like Thai food. There is plenty of Thai food that is not just incredibly hot, but that's sort of a signature feature. The other thing, right or wrong, I think that Indian food is recognized for is curry powder. Now, curry can be its own study. It's a whole career, but accepting that those are the two things, what are some of the how does curry tie together? Does it tie together all of this country? Is it something that we could say, wow, this actually does apply in 29 states?
I wouldn't say curry. I mean, for me, in my world, curry is a bastardized word of masala, which is a direct result of colonization of those countries. I mean, there is no English word, there's no Indian word which says curry. I mean, that's like, there isn't anything I have ever come across. We never said curry or curry. When we were growing up, we never called anything curry.
Okay. So for you, it would have been garam masala.
It would have been masala. It wouldn't have been garam masala. So garam masala, garam in Indian language or Hindi is hot. And masala is basically a blend and spice mix which goes together. Now, garam masala is not necessarily hot spicy, but it is spice which is hot in that it has like a delayed effect. So it doesn't heat you up initially. It doesn't heat up your tongue immediately, but it does kick it in afterwards after you consume it. And they use garam masala for many reasons. For tenderizing, they use it as a preservative. Because if you go into the history of Indian food, as you mentioned, you know, in terms of transportation, water scarcity, there were some challenges of the food prepared, and they also believed for many years there was in some of the tropical areas one would not allow the food to stay for too long, depending on the humidity level. So the spices and masalas were used to practically preserve the food without having a requirement to either refrigerate or reheat or keep it at a hot zone and still keep the food safe to eat.
Now, that is something I didn't know, because I'm familiar with the fact that I've got probably one or two different kinds of masala in my cabinet, but I didn't realize it was also the preservative. Makes a lot of sense if you think about it.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So there is nothing like curry. I don't know what to tell you about curry. It's like...
Well, so let me ask you this then. So when most people use the word curry, they mean the dried mix of spices. If we look at, like I mentioned, Thailand has, and maybe the coastal regions do too in India, there's the fresh paste of lemongrass and garlic and onions and peppers, and I mean, who knows what else is in there. Is that a masala in India? Does that even exist as a product?
It does. It may not have the same exact spice mix, but the only ingredient I have found common in all the curries I've read is turmeric. That is the only common ingredient I have come across. So if you look at some of the Asian spices or the South Asian, as well as the Indian spices, which are related with curry, they have turmeric as one of the bases. So I'm not sure exactly where the word curry came from. And curry usually is associated, so if you do curry powder, it's associated with dry spice mix. But a curry, if it's in a wet form or a paste form or in a liquid form, I would associate that with a sauce. So they're different, you know. I mean, when you look at a Thai curry, you assume when you see it on a menu, the Thai curry is something which has a sauce in it.
Right, like the red or the green or the masaman.
And same thing with Indian curry, so you have a curry powder, which I've noticed if it's an Indian curry powder, it has one of the three basic ingredients. And it's turmeric, it's cumin, and it's coriander powder. But I guess as people sell different curry mixes, they add and subtract. But the common three ingredients is what my understanding of curry is.
Well, and so we've probably made our own mixes when we were in Tallahassee. But and so I knew enough that it was a mix, but that it was always turmeric was, I'm not.
Probably common.
Yeah.
And turmeric, if you look into its nutritional values and everything, what it does, it is an antioxidant. It's prevents you from infections of the stomach. And it's a very common medical treatment. Give it to you. You have turmeric tablets. I remember when growing up, if we ever got cut on our hands or legs, they used to get a turmeric paste and just apply it, and it used to be fine.
Really?
Yes. You'd be shocked. Just plain turmeric and water, and you apply it on a wound, and your wound will heal. It's a guarantee. There's no ifs and buts of it. So it is very fascinating when it comes to how little we know of some of these spices which have been used traditionally for I don't know how many odd years.
Well, thousands probably. Let's talk a little bit about cooking techniques. One of the things that I think is probably the most known in Indian cooking would be the tandoor. And it's possible that people don't know what that is. So what is a tandoor?
Tandoor is basically a clay oven. You have different shapes and forms of tandoor. It's developed mainly in the northern part of India, where they would have these clay ovens. And when I look at a clay oven, it can be different versions of it. It could be a hole in the ground. The sides of that oven are coated with a clay material, which becomes into a natural non-stick area. They usually put the coals. Now you have gas tandoors, as you have electric tandoors, But the old school was either it was firewood or it was coals, which were put into the bottom of that clay oven. And it was designed as, I wouldn't say a pyramid, but as a dome with the lip of the opening being a small, like a bottle. And the base would be broad. The sides would be clay. And they would use it to cook different types of food, right from meats to vegetables to flatbreads. The clay on the sides, the way it was designed is they would take the flatbread and stick it onto the side of those ovens. And it would not fall off, and then they would just scrape it off, and that's how the breads would cook. So not it is like a inverted pizza oven. If you look at it, the only thing is that the flatbread would stick to the clay oven. Now the skewered meats would be on long, I would say 3 feet skewers, where they would be able to put pieces of meat. And depending on different techniques and how well people are used to their tandoor, they would be able to adjust the heat with a small window in the bottom of whether they want to cook the meat slowly or not. And the other thing what tandoors used to be used at, so once the coal and the clay tandoors would remain hot for nearly 6-7 hours, even after switching them off. And once you get that coal, so they would take all the lentils and stews, all the beans, put them in water, and let it cook in that heat overnight or even for 6-7 hours. In that same heat, it would stew, and then you would have your lentil stews or dals, different types of dals, ready for either supper or the next day.
So a tandoor is kind of like a hearth.
Yes.
And so, I mean, one of the things that I think we're used to seeing in America is the open fire, and then you pull coals or logs, not fire logs, but you know the embers to one side and do your roasting on just open flame. Like, I mean, there's the book Cooking with Fire is all about hearth cooking.
Yes,
it's a fascinating read, but it sounds so. Is my guess, this is just trying to puzzle this out, is that the tandoor was to some degree portable and possibly originated with nomadic people, or is that a bad guess?
The memories I have and what I remember seeing were tandoors were built outside the house. It's like when you go to Italy, everybody has a clay pizza oven in the back. So I don't think it was something which was transported. What's available right now, and you're absolutely correct, is you do get portable tandoors. What may have been transported initially would be directly the clay ovens without the ground and everything associated with it. So like you see a hot oven, which is made, like you see a pizza oven, it's made inside a concrete structure or a brick or soil, and it's covered around it where the tandoor's made. So that's, you may be right. I'm not really very sure on that, on this one.
Well, it seems a reasonable hunch, but it's my part-time backyard historian coming out. Let's talk a little bit about terminology. And one of the things that I bumped into when we were working in Tallahassee was the thing I remember, and I got to tell you, it's still it is still the memory of what is a samosa supposed to be. It's the thing that Azur made that one day, and nothing has come close. But you made a chutney. And so though this was interesting. So with my French cooking background, even though I've never left the country, chutneys to most of us mean that sweet and sticky and sometimes a little bit of heat, fruit gloppy thing, which looks like an extra thick jam. And you made a chutney which didn't resemble chutney to me at all. So I was like, well, this is interesting. So as far as condiments go, now maybe this is really a question about condiments and not terminology, although it was an interesting observation. It seems that Indian food is almost nothing without its condiments?
I wouldn't say that. But condiments do play a very important part in the different courses of the meal.
So what would one normally have with dinner?
So they depending on what type of food you have. So I think chutneys. So okay, let's talk about chutney a little bit. Now, so most of the chutneys are served cold.
Okay.
They're rarely ever served warm or hot. What I've understood with the word chutney is anything which is made into a paste or ground is a chutney. Whether it is sweet and salty, whether it's savory, whether it has yogurt, whether it has cilantro, and there are various different types of chutneys. So anything which is ground with a mortar and pestle and thick pasty is called a chutney. And you have similar flavored pickles. The Indian word would be achar. And I'm not sure whether achar is a purely Indian word or is it a Mughal word which came from those kingdoms which were there at one time. So achar or pickle is something where you have whole vegetables and fruits pickled and spiced with different various Indian spices and oils. Now these pickles and these chutneys and pickles are had as a condiment when you have blander Indian food, which would be, for example, the spice levels of these chutneys and pickles vary quite a bit. So you have bland chutneys also. So if you eat a spicy samosa, the cooling chutney would be something which would be yogurt, cilantro, and mint base, which would complement that particular samosa. Because you have different types of samosas, right? You have potato and chickpeas, and every region has a different samosa covering as well as a filling. And then the chutneys vary as a condiment to accompany that particular dish. So if it was something which was spicy by itself, it would have a cooling chutney associated with it. Now, if you had a bland dinner item like plain yellow dal and rice, being pretty bland on its own, you would accompany it with a spicier preserve or a chutney or a pickle, which would be on a spicier nature. That's the easiest way to make to get into the difference between chutneys, because the spices vary and how it is used in with what types of food.
A spicy pickle is an interesting idea. I know that we've got some of those here, but I'm actually a giant wimp when it comes to heat. So that's
scared. He's scared to eat it. And I don't blame you, because I think I mean, some of these spicy pickles are extremely potent. And the amount of pickles you would eat with the type of food, which is a bland rice and a lentil, would be actually very less. So it's all about balance when it comes to some of these Indian spices and food. What has changed is the availability of these spices and foods has become so much more and easier. When we go into historic evidence of how these pickles and spices were eaten, some of them were eaten in farmlands where you would use the pickle or the preserve with some of the flatbreads. Because when you're working on the farm, you did not have a refrigerator or you did not have the means to keep everything fresh. So you would get a thick flatbread. And you would accompany it with either a spicy or a sweet and salty pickle, which would serve as your sauce or some sort of something for you to sustain yourself. Over time, the availability has become more, but that's the easiest way I could explain to you would be that chutneys and pickles are as accompaniments, but depending on what meal you're serving, you would serve those types of chutneys and pickles.
Right. You've mentioned flatbreads a couple of times, and so the most popular one, I feel pretty certain that the one everyone's familiar with is naan. Are there other kinds of flatbreads, or is naan sort of the thing? And then depending on what region you're in, or maybe it's like minestrone soup, it changes based on which house you're in. So it's got a basic thing, and then depending on where you go, is garnish a change, or are there more kinds of flatbreads?
Oh, there are hundreds of types of flatbreads.
All right.
There are hundreds of flatbreads. It's a broad aspect. Naan is, we call it roti, R-O-T-I. The naan would be a type of roti. So if you're sitting in a restaurant, naan is one way of cooking a flatbread. But then there is, in naan itself, there are must be at least 25, 30 different varieties of naan, depending on what toppings you can put on it, what type of flour you use, what type of proofing you do. Do you proof it with yeast or yogurt or milk? Do you have it soft? Do you make it rich with butter and ghee? So it goes on into that aspect. Then you have parathas, which is made on... naans usually are made inside a tandoor or a hot oven, would be my understanding. And parathas and other flatbreads are made on a flat top, which we don't have. They used to not have flat top, but they would call it a tawa. T-A-W-A. It's a tawa. It's usually made out of cast iron. Now you do get it stainless steel and non-stick, but traditionally it was made out of cast iron or iron. And then you would just have heat from one side. And you would roll the bread with a rolling pin. And you could either layer the bread with product in it, like aloo and cauliflower, and make it into a stuffed paratha, or you just have a plain paratha. So the list of breads would just go on. I mean, I don't think that I would be able to explain that every region has a different flatbread. So that's you're basing those breads only out of wheat flour and whole wheat. But then you go into bajra, maize, rice flour, lentil flour, and then the combinations of all these above flours mixed into a flatbread.
Now, that is fascinating. And from someone who fancies himself a baker, that's very exciting. Because now I'm thinking about, oh my gosh, I need to get some lentil flour and some chickpea flour, and I need to go play with these things. Because this sounds... Correct. This sounds really fascinating. And I would imagine that, and though leavening with yogurt, I don't even know what this means. I have no concept of this. So now I'm thinking, all right, now I got to figure out how to do this. Because now I want to try this, because this is interesting. And I'm pleased to learn this. I'm disappointed it took so long.
Yeah, but at least you learned it. That's a good part, right? At least you did something new.
Yeah. Well, yeah, now I got to make this. I got to figure out how to do this. We spoke before, and so one of my little is helping people find success with baking and cooking on their own terms. What that means is, instead of trying to and if you can, that's great. But some people go to if people go to Spago or Boulay or Le Cirque or even someplace that's a nice dining restaurant in their town and say, wow, well, I want to make this, and they go home and try. If they don't, one of the reasons they may have not succeeded is it's not a fair comparison. That the restaurant, even the one across the street, has more resources than your home kitchen, between access to better ingredients at a cheaper price and staff and lots of stainless steel counters. And it's just all sorts of reasons why you can't very easily recreate your most favorite meal. So I want to change the expectations from don't try to make the meal you had. Work, of course, to make the best meal you can, but let's find a different way to succeed so that there is success and the cook says, wow, look what I did. This is great, as opposed to, see, I told you I can't do it. And I think when we get into something that's unknown, and so every nation's cooking to an American is mostly unknown. Even to somebody who's from France, Indian cooking or Thai cooking or Vietnamese cooking it's just odd. It's just there's things that are not they're not intuitive. And some of that is, so the spices, I think, confuse a lot of people, get scared because I don't want to make it too hot, which certainly could happen. So how can we find a way to encourage people who are willing to experiment with either buying some curry powder from the store or making their own and exploring curry, exploring Indian food, exploring these new kinds of breads, exploring different flavors, and still assure them that if they've made something they enjoy eating, there's a real good chance that somebody in India made that exact same dish, so you're succeeding even if you think that you're not. It's a really long intro. As a teacher, because now you're an employer, you are in charge of people, and you have people who don't know what they're doing, and so how can we encourage the listener the way you would encourage your cook to pursue this dish and feel confident you've done a good job?
Okay. So the first thing is, that depends on what you're trying to replicate. Now, in Indian food or any type of cuisine, there are some traditional favorites which are what they are, right? And like you say, samosa. Now, the samosa which you know or which you have had maximum exposure to is something which is filled potatoes, green peas, it has cumin in it, and it has a flaky pastry covering it. So that would be, if you look at something of that nature, what you're trying to replicate. Now, if you took the same samosa and say wrapped it up in a wonton shell, so the same filling, you take it in a wonton shell, there's a possibility that there could be some part of India which may have had that influence over all these years, either from China or from historic, I don't know, you could go back into history, and there could be a stuffing which was done that way. So you could possibly have made something which would have been of Indian origin and yet not taste exactly like the traditional samosa. So the answer to your question is what I'm understanding is, as much as they're traditional food items which restaurants make, some of these restaurants don't always market those foods in the true essence of what it may have originally been, for various reasons, for palate. You know, I mean, if you make something really traditional, not everybody likes it, because then you have only a market range of only those people who are wanting that. So if you take a restaurant food item and you try to replicate it at home, and if you do change a few things around, with still getting some of the basics right, you still did a good job with it, as long as it tastes good and it's something which is palatable, is how I look at it. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think one of the ideas I'm working toward is twofold at least, that words on a piece of paper aren't gospel. It's a good guide, but sometimes either you don't like mushrooms or you don't have an ingredient listed, and that's not a reason to stop. So making a dish, at least honoring the spirit of the dish, is, and then being palatable and people appreciate it, say, wow, this is really good. I think cooking in that way, and honoring the idea and the spirit of the dish, and maybe omitting cumin because you don't like it or whatever, as long as that happens, I think that kind of a success is really worth pursuing. And that's the kind of thing that people who struggle with uncertainty over their cooking or baking skills, I think this is the change the expectation part.
I totally agree with you. And I think a lot of it has got to do with people not wanting to think outside the box. And thanks for Google and the digital world, because say you do samosa and you put it in Google, it's going to give you one of the most standard recipes, which they assume, which is samosa, which is with potatoes and chickpeas, with potatoes and green peas and cumin in a floury pastry shell. And I think people tend to, and I'm stuck on the samosa right now, but I think it's the easiest way to make someone understand it. People get stuck on that whole fact that that is the only recipe for samosa. So when they try something new, they always feel that, well, you know what, it is wrong. But they, like you said, the very fact that you try something and you can keep some of the concepts same and try out something different, that's what it would take. And I think that's what creativity and cooking is all about. And for some reason, we as chefs sometimes, and especially with some of the newer chefs I see in the workplace, they're scared to try out something new, because they already have this preconceived notion that this is what it's supposed to look like.
That's an interesting idea, because when I was when I was a young cook, I was scared to make a mistake, because I thought that whatever is I'm making, especially when you're talking about French food, because there's Trinidad's Rossini, and then there's a thousand ways for it to be wrong. But in terms of just experimenting and trying to put flavors together, now if you're trying to make an Escoffier masterpiece, well, then the margin for error is pretty thin, because that's sort of well known and there isn't a whole lot of interpretation available, really. Although if you read carefully, Chicken Maryland is fried chicken, so knock yourself out. If we're talking about provincial French cuisine, or provincial Italian cuisine, or Indian cuisine, or Vietnamese cuisine, then we have a whole other opportunity to succeed, because conceivably somebody in Thailand or India or Italy or Vietnam has made this dish this way because that's what that cook preferred. And so I think having a lower bar, meeting the spirit of the thing, and this is getting redundant, is one of the ways we can get to success, working our way up to making that really fussy Escoffier dish, which is going to take a lot of time. And depending on which one you choose, if it's something with truffles or foie gras, you're going to be spending some money on it. So let's not make mistakes, things like that. So
yeah, but if you go back into Escoffier's life, the only thing different he did was he documented it and it became the gospel. But he did the same thing what most of the other cooks would do, is tried out different things in different ways and forms and shapes.
And he did, and he recorded all that too.
Correct.
So that's
a big difference, you know. So he did try out different things. He did try out the ways it would fail. And then he decided that this was the best way he liked it.
Well, that's an important observation. So the La Guide Culinaire is the book of the successes. What doesn't exist, well, that's not really true, because if you look at Le Livre de Menu is his book in French of maybe all of his menus throughout his life, or at least a good part of it. And there's a lot of things on there that aren't in Escoffier, in La Guide. And there might be a good reason for that, but that's an interesting point, that Escoffier wasn't batting 1,000. There was a lot of things that didn't work. You just don't know about them, and right. We don't know about them. Good point. Let's move on for 1 second about dessert, because I love sugar. I'm a big dessert fan, and I know that the idea of rice pudding is going to put some people off automatically. It's just, this is terrible. But I'm going to say, and I don't remember where, it may have been Orlando. My memory's mixing it up, but it could very well have been a saffron cardamom rice pudding, which was divine. That was absolutely spectacular. So let's talk about Indian desserts for a quick second.
Indian desserts is as crazy as all the other Indian food. You have so many variations, but just one thing which is common, that they're all sweet.
And sometimes, oh my, I mean sweet, like boy howdy this.
Yes, like, yes. So you have something from extremely sweet to extremely rich in terms of fat, or, and you can have it rich even in terms of nuts. So simple thing like rice pudding, okay? You had the saffron version of rice pudding. But every culture of India, if it's from a religious background or demographic location, they have different variations of rice pudding. You're shocked?
No, I'm not shocked. I'm
okay. So they do have different. So they have rice and vermicelli puddings. They have only rice puddings. They have something called firni, F-P-H-I-R-N-I. So it's a blended rice pudding, which is as smooth and creamy as ever. Those are some of the rice puddings I know. And then even in the rice pudding flavor profile, you have something which is served cold, something which is served warm. But the only thing common amongst all of them is that there's rice in it and sweet.
And so tell me about some of the, probably pistachios, but maybe some other nuts. What other nut desserts are popular ones?
Use a lot of pistachio, a lot of almonds, a lot of cashew nuts, and I would say peanuts also. So those are the common used. Then there's walnuts, which is always used with some sort of a fruit, like walnuts and figs. They call it anjeer in India. It's a very common. So then they have dates and almond desserts. And then they have some sort of halwas and desserts. So they call it halwa, H-A-L-W-A. That usually has a mixture of various types of nuts.
Very good. Well, I have a few more questions for you, which you don't know about. This is my surprise. But before I ask you that, we've talked a lot about really spectacular food, but we've done nobody any help because we haven't told them how they can learn about this. So there are a couple of cookbooks that you are aware of that you would say, this is a great place to begin to learn about the spirit of Indian cooking.
You know, that's a real hard question you asked me, Dan. I have practically zero Indian cookbooks.
So it looks like there's a market, Azur. Get writing.
I mean, honestly, I have never collected Indian cookbooks. I think there is one Indian cookbook which I collected when I was in culinary school, and it was called Prasad. P-R-A-S-H-A-D, Prashad. And the reason why I collected that book, because those recipes were written by actual chefs.
Is that that little green book?
Who worked in... Yes.
Oh, my goodness. There was that shrimp dish that had about 9,000 spice peppers in there for one shrimp. I don't know how anybody could possibly eat that thing.
But those recipes are good. They're different, but they're good. They work.
Yeah, but...
Too hot.
Too hot. Well, so what about people? Maybe there's, I can't say, Madhura Jaffrey?
Yes, Madhura Jaffrey, yes. I would say Sanjeev, I can't remember his name now. Sanjeev is his first name. Sanjeev Kapoor. Sanjeev Kapoor, his recipes are pretty good. Okay. They're quite tried and tested. He's an old school chef, cooked in very traditional ways. And some of his TV shows do a lot of justice to authentic Indian cooking. I'll have to do some research on
Indian. All right, well, that's just cookbooks. Something that you can look for. So my last, this is a real quick portion. If you've ever seen the TV show Inside the Actor's Studio, at the end he asks the actors some questions. And this is in the style of that. Of the five flavors, sweet, salty, bitter, sour, and umami, which one do you enjoy the most?
Sweet.
What's your favorite food?
I would say biryani.
Uh-huh. What's your least favorite food?
Bread pudding, which my mom used to make.
Jack's recipe, I assume.
Yeah.
What gets you excited?
Spices and the different things spices can do to food.
Okay. What turns you off?
When someone uses a lot of ingredients and the product still tastes like nothing.
What sound do you love?
Drums.
What sound do you hate?
Scratching of a cat on a glass or something.
And what is your favorite food indulgence?
Favorite food indulgence? A lot of meats, which could be a lot of grilled meats.
A what?
Is my favorite indulgence, where it goes into kebabs and
nice
skewered tandoori tikkas, and I think that would be my favorite indulgence.
Wow, that's a pretty good one. I like that. All right, Azur, my one and only friend, which is for anybody who wants to know, I actually have more than one friend. That is I'm taking something from a fellow we worked with in Tallahassee, Tony Sykes, who. When things got really busy, Tony and Azur were each other's best friends. So thank you very much for joining me today. I appreciate your time. I'm sure you probably need to get busy because now it's 3 o'clock on your time. So I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. It's great talking to you after so many years, and it's amazing. When I'm talking to you, you know, the whole image of Tallahassee and working in Governor's Club is just like revolving in the back of my head. And I can still hear the noises and rush of getting lunch and dinner out.
Oh, the rush of committee weeks. And we've got 7 buffets all right now, and you're already behind and get going. Yeah.
It was a crazy time.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's impossible to, you know, no one would believe it.
I still remember when we used to cook in that restaurant down, we had to go and get all the products from the main floor kitchen. And I don't know how many times I climbed the steps. I never had one of those Apple watches to calculate the number of steps I took. But I could guess it would be like...
You may not want to know. You know, remember how we got down, yes. Right? Flight by flight. Jump, 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 jump. My knees are still shot from that.
Oh, my God.
There was a lot of fun and some not so much fun.
Yeah.
So it goes. Those are the war stories we get to laugh about now.
Yeah, we're laughing over it now, but I'm sure we cussed out every time we had to end.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, lots. Lots of times when Jack was not pleased.
I hear you.
All right. Well, have a fabulous afternoon. Thank you again. I appreciate your time, and we will talk again soon.
Thanks, Ed. You take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, folks. That's going to do it. Whether you buy curry or masala, already mixed, or enjoy mixing your own to your own particular preferences, Savory Spice has a great selection of pre-mixed curries or the ingredients with which to mix your own. Click over to culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice and shop the vast selection of dry spices and mixed spices. From curry to steak rubs and seasoning packets for whole meal, Savory Spice is my go-to spice company. culinarylibertarian.com/savoryspice. Have a great week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matt Bankert at mattbankert.com.